Why did F1 get rid of V10 engines? What if Nigel Mansell had stayed with Williams rather than going to Ferrari? And should Alain Prost be part of any debate about the greatest F1 drivers of all time? Those are just a handful of the questions from the wonderful people in the Race Members Club that we'll be tackling today in the first of three bonus Ask Us Anything episodes we're doing after Series 9. And if you're listening to the preview of this episode in the Bring Back V10's main feed, you'll get to hear the first few questions before we make this a members-only affair, but we'd love for you to join us for the whole thing. So check out the link in the description of this episode if you'd like to sign up, and we promise if you do join us, you'll have plenty to keep you occupied until Series 10 kicks off in early July. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can probably see a little button offering you to sign up directly there. You can do that for a slightly different price than if you join us directly at the race, but you will get all of our exclusive members-only audio direct into your Apple Podcasts feed. So worth a look. And Andrew Vandenberg and Mark Hughes are here with me today. Welcome along, gents.
Hello.
Let's crack straight in, though, to answering some questions so we don't keep our members waiting. Mark, you can have the first one from Daniel Hayes, who simply asks, why did F1 move away from V10 engines in 2006?
So it was a two birds with one stone move by the FIA, safety and costs. I think the real imperative was probably coming from the manufacturers, who were spending these enormous sums of R&D and making all these fantastic gains, but at a hell of a cost and unbudgeted cost in some cases. So they're having to go to the boards and ask for more money to fund these competitive drive that they had. And so Peugeot had left. Renault was making noises about it being too expensive. Mercedes was having trouble justifying the unbudgeted spend of the board. And these costs were, of course, they were being passed on to the customer teams. Prost had gone out of business. Part of its debt was to Ferrari for engines. Sauber was screaming. There was very little technical restriction on the V10s. So you could research all sorts of ways of getting the crankshaft height half a centimetre lower, or lowering the centre of gravity, or playing with different cylinder spacings, looking at the structural demands in detail, see where you could shave the weight off. And they're already down to under 90 kilos for a 3-litre V10. So that was where the demand for a less esoteric set of engine regs came from. But at the same time, the FIA was becoming concerned about the ever faster lap times and how it was threatening to make circuits obsolete. So they decided to do it all in one go, and they decided making this new formula, and I think Cosworth were one of the main architects of it, they would reduce the capacity. And if you just take two cylinders off a 3-litre V10, you get 2.4 litres, and that's what they did, reasoning you could retain the existing combustion and head design, etc., so saving some spend because you'd already done that research. But the V8s were much more prescriptive. The crankshaft height was defined, the cylinder spacings were defined, the minimum centre of gravity height was stipulated, certain exotic materials were banned, variable intake manifolds banned, and there was a minimum weight of 95 kilos, so heavier than the V10s despite being smaller.
Andy, if I've got my timelines right, you'd have been editor of Autosport magazine by this point?
Yeah, I took over late 2005.
Okay, so as this was happening, as the editor of that magazine, did this even register? Obviously, we kind of tongue-in-cheek go, oh my goodness, it was the end of an era here. Did it feel significant at all at the time?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Obviously, we'd had those engines for a long period of time, and I think we would have been quite excited about something new coming in, and the ability for that to shake up the order, to introduce new levels of competitiveness. And there was genuinely a feeling that with the cost the way they were, the whole sport was potentially under threat of the manufacturers pulling out or just pricing the independents out of the game. So I think we were broadly excited and behind it. You don't know what you got till it's gone, do you? I don't think we thought that we would be looking back at this V10 era quite so fondly, because you want to live in the moment. But we, you know, as you well know, for being news editor for how many years you were, all news is good news, right? When you've got pages to fill.
Yeah, that's a good point. And manufacturers are quite helpful for news as well, because they tend to be, well, people are interested in them and they tend to be playing games behind the scenes. So as fun as it might be if everyone had an equal Cosworth engine or something like that, we'd lose a lot of things to talk about. Andy, you can take the next question from Michael Armadi, who asks, who are your picks for the best among the many French drivers that emerged from 1989 to 1995, excluding Jean Alesi and Olivier Panis? And Michael adds, personally, I would vote for Eric Comas or Bertrand Gachot, who for the purposes of this question will consider French.
Well, I'm not going to allow Michael to have Gachot there. He was a citizen of the EU, wasn't he? Funnily enough, relating directly to my last answer, I think one of the final things I did before I became editor was a piece on what happened to all the French drivers, because we had a picture from the, I think it would have been early 79, possibly the 79 season opener, which are Argentina, wasn't it, Mark? And we sort of highlighted the number of French drivers on the grid. And I interviewed François Guiter, who was at Elf at the time and had basically funded all of those young French drivers coming through, with the possible exception of, was Arnoux an outlier? Anyway, that's another bring back DfE's question. I was covering GP2 at the time, and when I was in the paddock, as he was absolutely wont to do, Jean-Paul Drio came up to me and started ranting about this article, saying, I've taken more French drivers into Formula One than Elf ever did. And if you look back over the period that this question goes through, not only were Panis, Olivier Bernard, Jean-Marc Gounon, Jean-Christophe Bouillon, Franck Lagorce, they all went through dams on their way into F1. A couple of other notable Frenchies they had as well, Eric Ellery and Jérôme Polycon. But I think the best of them was a guy who never raced in F1. I think he may have only done one or two tests, and that was Laurent Aiello.
It would have been
fabulous to have seen what chance he would have got in F1, but sadly he never did, although he was a fabulous touring car driver.
Yeah, what a choice.
I heard about the test that he did with McLaren, and basically his neck went, and up until that time he was going quicker than Hakkinen had gone through the fast sweeps. I can't remember which circuit it was. I think it might have been Estoril. And the team was sort of open mouthed. He was one of the great lost talents of that didn't get into F1.
Do you have a pick of your own, Mark?
Well, I mean, if you objectively, Alesi was the best of that bunch, wasn't he? But he wasn't as good as the best of the previous generation, Prost. Still some way off, in fact, as their respective performances as teammates at Ferrari in 91 confirmed. I've got an anecdote about Eric Comas from 94, if you want to hear that.
Go for it.
I was racing TVRs at the time, and we were testing at Goodwood pre-season, just to make sure the thing could go around the track without setting fire to
itself.
They
must be quite hairy around Goodwood.
Yeah, there was. You just thought I'd take your brain out. Eric Comas was mates with somebody that was racing a Caterham in the British Caterham series. And this guy had got Eric Comas to come and test his Caterham for him at Goodwood. And it was just after the Brazilian Grand Prix, 94 Brazilian Grand Prix. And so I'm standing in the, you know, in the Goodwood pit lane waiting for the car to be ready. And there's Eric Comas in the next garage. So I just went and had a chat with him and asked what he was doing here. And he's explaining. He's in this little blue Caterham. And anyway, through the day, we're all going round, and there was no marshals there, no flags or anything. It's just a test day. And so I come round what's the left hander after St. Mary's, or is that St. Mary's? The fast blind.
I think that is St.
Left.
Mary's, isn't it?
Quite fast.
Well, they're all fast.
That's St. Mary's, is it? And I come over there, and Comas's Caterham spun in the middle of the track, and he's just climbed out of it. I don't know, something must have broken. He's just climbed out of it, and he's just standing in the middle of the track looking at it.
Oh, my gosh.
And I come over that crest doing, I don't know, 120 or something like that, and I have to actually steer onto the grass and to miss him. So, yeah, we could have lost Eric Comas from the 94 season if I'd not being on the ball in that particular moment.
You had your wits about you.
That is not the anecdote I was expecting.
Yeah.
No, me neither.
No. or did I dream that? I might have dreamt that.
No, regardless, it's a great story. I made my car racing debut against Eric Comas's son, Anthony.
Uh-huh.
And I spent most of the race holding him up because he spun early on. I was driving around at the back in a talking of French stuff, La Filière Formula Campus. And I was driving around at the back at Le Mans, and Comas spun off. And then I spent most of the race holding him up. I can't remember if he got me or not, but he was a lot quicker than I was. Right, that's enough about our racing exploits. We've already recorded one of these that will come out later, involving Ben Anderson and Matt Beer, and Ben managed to talk about his racing exploits as well. So I think that'll be the end of it. We'll have no more stories about us. Mark, next question is from Ansi Rulamo, who wants to know, was there anything particular behind Mika Hakkinen's stunning starts in 2000? He took the lead from the second row at Nürburgring, Hockenheim and Hungaroring. And of course, he overtook Schumacher at the start from second on the grid at Suzuka, as he had the year before in 1999.
Yeah, interesting question. I don't know if McLaren had some trick clutch system or whether the Mercedes just had a nicer, more friendly torque curve than the Ferrari at that stage. But that said, you're comparing those starts in the main to Michael, because he's, you know, wherever Mika was, Michael was right next to him at that time, 99, 2000, and Michael's reactions were notoriously poor. So some of it might not have been Mika being incredibly quick and reacting to the lights, but Michael being slow, and his reactions and those of Rubens Barrichello were tested at Ferrari. And I was talking to Ross Brawn about the test a few days later, and he was saying, yeah, he said, they're just really average. He said that they're about the same as mine, you know, same as Ross's. Because, you know, Ross had taken the test as well. And he said, no, he was like bang in the middle of, there's loads of people in the factory had taken this test. And Michael was somewhere in the middle. And Barrichello's were consistently better. And yet when Barrichello had been in Formula 3, because I was covering Formula 3 at that time, his starts at the beginning of 91 were so poor that Dick Bennett's took him and his other driver, Jordi Hinet, up to Santa Pod with the F3 cars just to practice starts. And Barrichello's reactions were found to be consistently slower than Genet's. So Michael's were slower than Barrichello's, whose were slower than Genet's. And the idea that fast reactions are what makes drivers fast is totally bogus. It's about how early their senses and their body pick up messages from the car, not how quickly they react to them. And it's a subtle distinction, but it's one that's laid bare when all you're reacting to is a light rather than any message from the car.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that. So what you're saying is, really, Ferrari needed Jordi Genet to get the car off the line and then,
and then Michael take over.
Michael Schumacher.
Yeah.
Okay, if you're listening to our preview of this episode in the main feed, that's all you're getting, I'm afraid. Now is a great time to check out the Race Members Club. This is one of three Ask Us Anything bonus episodes we're doing for our members. We've got all sorts of exclusive content we'll be releasing between now and the start of Series 10 in July. So you don't have to go without your Bring Back V10's fix if you don't want to. We've, of course, got our much-hyped run-through of the 1997 season to come as well, where we'll be doing a short episode on every single race. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up directly there to get all of the races bonus audio content. You just get a few more benefits if you come to us directly via our website. So have a look and decide what you want to do. We're now going to crack on. We've still got all sorts of questions. We've got the Nigel Mansell one that I mentioned at the top. And we've got an absolute... I've called it the Alain Prost section. We got so many Alain Prost questions, which is fascinating, that we put a chunk of this episode will be devoted to that. So if you're a Prost fan, you'll probably want to sign up to hear us talk about Alain a bit more.